Impressionable standards. Yet even the church that prides itself on being the one least likely to bend to or shift with the times, the Roman Catholic Church, is just as capable of caving in to the new religion of the current era. In June 2020, the Catholic chaplain of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Reverend Daniel Patrick Maloney, sent out a cautionary email to the Catholic community at the university, warning them, at the height of the protests, that George Floyd's killing may have had nothing to do with racism. He also questioned Floyd's character, given his previous convictions for violence. He said that while Floyd should not have been killed by the police officer, Floyd himself had not lived a virtuous life. He wrote, "Most people in the country have framed this as an act of racism. I don't think we know that." Speaking of police violence, Maloney warned against seeing racism as a major problem in the American police. "Again, I don't think we know that," he wrote. "The police deal with dangerous and bad people all the time, and that often hardens them," he said. Inevitably, the message was leaked out, and the mob came after him. A small number of people in the MIT community expressed hurt at the contents of the email. A vice president and dean for student life said that the message from Father Maloney was deeply disturbing. She accused Maloney of devaluing and disparaging George Floyd's character and of failing to acknowledge systemic racism. And the Catholic Church decided to give in to the new gospel. The Archdiocese of Boston swiftly distanced itself from the comments, and Maloney issued an apology for the hurt he had caused. The Archdiocese also asked Maloney to resign his position with immediate effect. Consequences. Perhaps it is inevitable that when the churches have such a view of themselves and their own history, people will take them at their word. What should someone with no knowledge of the churches make of institutions that say such things about themselves? An ever-increasing percentage of people have no experience of the Church of England, the Episcopalian Church, or any other church. When such institutions announce that they are institutionally racist and riven with bigotry, an outsider with no knowledge of them is likely to believe them. Why should they not? After all, who would say such things about themselves unless they were true? You have to know such institutions very well to know that they are not what their leaders say they are, to know that most clergy spend their lives devoting themselves to their flock, helping the poor and doing good works. For people who have no experience of these institutions, there is no reason not to view them through the demonic lens through which they present themselves. And it is perhaps inevitable that, in time, that mix of ignorance and presumption of guilt will have consequences. In July 2021, when Canada was going through another orgy of statue toppling, one of the proximate causes that month was a strange moral panic that had taken hold in the country. The Canadian media had recently begun to report that numerous graves had been found near residential schools run by the Catholic Church in areas with First Nations communities in them. On the evidence of one unverified report, based on ground penetration radar that was inconclusive, it was claimed that hundreds of unmarked graves existed. The media in Canada and then around the world claimed that the mass graves contained the bodies of children, with the strong implication that they were Indigenous children, and the follow-on implication that they had been deliberately murdered by the Catholic Church. No bodies were found, and nothing had even been excavated. It was not clear that they were all children, or that they were not in individual graves formerly marked by wooden crosses. Canadians already knew from a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that thousands of students had died of diseases such as tuberculosis at these crowded schools. People started to burn down churches in Canada. Within a single week, almost 30 were torched or otherwise assaulted. The fact that many of the churches burned down were built by First Nations people did not detain those who had jumped on the anti-Canadian church's bandwagon. The then head of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association took to Twitter to say, "Burn it all down." Caitlin Urquhart, a former volunteer at the Newfoundland Canadian Bar Association branch, said the same thing. A radio host demanded, "Burn the churches down." A Canadian law professor described the burnings as resistance to extreme and systemic injustice. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's top advisor and friend, Gerald Butts, said that while burning churches was not advisable, it may be understandable. In no time, a story had gone from a claim of a discovery of graves to a story of mass graves to a story of children deliberately murdered by the Catholic Church and buried in mass graves to Canadians actually burning down churches because they had become convinced that the churches had orchestrated the deliberate and organized mass murder of children. Because of course the churches would. Because the churches are racist, like everything else. Rationalism. Still, even if the churches and all philosophy are regarded as racist, there can still be one other hope for the Western mind. One final refuge that still exists and which might be assumed to be sacrosanct. Simple logic and provable fact. We may not know our history or not be confident of our history or that our history was good. We may not be at all confident that the philosophical or theological roots of the West are not irredeemably corrupted by racism and its attendant sins. But there is at least the sanctuary of science, of math, of provable, verifiable fact. And on this ground, perhaps, something can be saved. Countries and churches may tremble, and histories may change, but the building blocks of logic, science, and math may still be relied upon. We may be sure of nothing else, but we may be certain that the Western traditions in these areas at least may continue. Once again, the hope is forlorn. One by one, the sense-making organs of the scientific community and other parts of the STEM world have fallen to the same one-note dogma of the time. The medical community was one of the first to fall into it. In the immediate aftermath of the George Floyd killing, public gatherings were still banned in most countries because of coronavirus restrictions. Governments had instituted such bans on the advice of the medical professionals. But as soon as the BLM protests began, more than 1,000 medical professionals in the United States signed a petition calling for them to be allowed to go ahead because opposition to racism is vital to the public health. As far as public health concerns went, the one thing that trumped even the coronavirus was racism. As the coronavirus crisis was going on, the lead journal of the medical world, The Lancet, ran a piece titled, "Racism is the Public Health Crisis." The publication also published an anti-racism pledge, professing that racism is a public health emergency of global concern. Anti-racism is a struggle all of us must join. The Lancet promised to educate ourselves about racism, pledge our solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, and turn that pledge into concrete actions in our own work. Other scientific journals have submitted to the same standard. In May 2021, Nature said in an editorial that the first anniversary of the death of George Floyd was a reminder to the journal that systemic racism in science exists, and that the staff of Nature had to recognize our part in it. And not just their own part, but the part of science as a whole in perpetuating racism. As Nature said, tackling systemic racism requires the system of science to change. One of the few concrete suggestions that the journal came up with was to ensure that anti-racism is embedded within all scientific organizations and that such work wins recognition and promotion. According to Nature, too often conventional metrics, citations, publication, profits, reward those in positions of power rather than helping to shift the balance of power. There is a lot in that. For instance, what is wrong with citations in scientific research? Is it better to have citations or not to have citations? The purpose of citations has generally been to provide evidence that the assertions contained are reliable and true. But if a scientific publication decides that such evidence is as good as an absence of evidence, or actually worse than an absence of evidence, then out goes one of the building blocks of the scientific method. Besides, why is it the task of a scientific journal to shift the balance of power? Why is its aim not simply to publish the best and most important research, whoever comes up with it, and whoever it benefits? It is at such times that one particularly conservative critique that used to exist in the culture wars is shown to be woefully inadequate. Conservatives used to joke that the wildest fringes of academic thought had boundaries that would be asserted naturally. These commentators claimed that ideas such as CRT may well run like wildfire through the humanities, but that even if this did happen, it did not matter overmuch. People were welcome to get themselves into debt studying for useless humanities degrees that educated them in non-disciplines, because all the time reality and the facts would continue to assert themselves in STEM subjects. These people asserted that while theory, with a capital T, might work in lesbian dance theory classes, it would halt at the borders of the hard sciences and mathematics. It would stop at the doors of engineering, because at some point the bridges had to stay up. Yet that claim, that hope, turns out to have been wildly optimistic. There turns out to be no reason why the tide that has rushed through everything else should halt at the borders of STEM. If you wanted to kick away the remaining building blocks on which everything else is built, then kicking away the block of mathematical certainty is a pretty good way to do it. It is a similar trick to kicking away the idea that there is any such fixed thing as men and women. It sows confusion without making anything else remotely clearer. But if you wish to simply disorient or demoralize people, then it is a good place to kick at. That is precisely what has been done in recent years with the development of equitable maths. This is the idea that math itself is problematic. The argument goes that math is elitist, privileged, and of course inherently racist. How can a system that owes its origins to several civilizations and was refined in the West in the last millennia be seen as systematically racist? One way of doing this is to rely on scholars who have spent recent decades trying to define a whole set of aspirational ideas as inherently white supremacist and then attempting to anathematize them out of the field of education. For instance, Kenneth Jones and Tima Okun's Dismantling Racism, a Workbook for Social Change Groups, has been used by a lot of people in the field of education since its first publication in 2001. That work identified a number of norms and standards that it claimed were damaging because they promote white supremacy thinking. The authors claimed that these norms were damaging both to people of colour and to white people. The characteristics selected as being especially damaging included perfectionism, worship of the written word, sense of urgency, individualism, and objectivity. According to Jones and Okun, the idea that there is only one right way to do something in education is white supremacist. Instead, they recommend that when working with communities from a different culture, educators should be clear that you have some learning to do about the community's ways of doing things. They also criticize white people for valuing logic over emotion. All of this is fairly disastrous just as theory, but trying to put it into practice is catastrophic. Take, for instance, a guide for teachers published 20 years after Jones and Okun's work. Equitable Maths describes itself as a pathway to equitable math instruction, intended as a resource to give guidance to teachers of Black, Latinx, and multilingual students in America between grades 6 and 8. It cites Jones and Okun at the beginning of its first section, which is on Dismantling Racism in Mathematics Instruction. It accepts and develops their definition of white supremacy and sees white supremacy as running throughout mathematics. As a result, and citing Kendi, obviously, it urges teachers to identify what it means to be an anti-racist math educator. What it apparently means is supporting students to reclaim their mathematical ancestry by seeking to honor and acknowledge the mathematical knowledge of students of color, even if it shows up unconventionally. Again and again, the teaching guide gives ways to dismantle the culture of white supremacy that exists within the math classroom. Again and again, it seeks to do so by advocating that teachers presume that Black, Latinx, and multilingual students already have some special knowledge of math that is hard or impossible for white people to appreciate or access. Worse, it presumes that non-white students find normal math hard or impossible to appreciate or access. As ever, this mania has not been limited to America. The same ideas have spilled out everywhere. Ontario's Grade 9 de-streamed math curriculum, taught in Toronto's public schools, has tried to weed out Eurocentric mathematical knowledges and replace them with a decolonial anti-racist approach to mathematics education. This emerges in small details, such as removing the credit we give to a Greek mathematician by replacing the Pythagorean theorem with the term side-length relationship for right triangles. But it emerges in large details too. For instance, it insists that, contrary to the Eurocentric approach, in an anti-racist and anti-discriminatory environment, teachers know that there is more than one way to develop a solution, and students are exposed to multiple ways of knowing and encouraged to explore multiple ways of finding answers. This includes indigenous pedagogical approaches that emphasize holistic experiential learning and the use of collaborative and engaging activities that show respect for the diverse and multiple ways of knowing that are relevant to and reflective of students' lived experiences. But what exactly are these other ways of knowing? What might they look like? One example of what anti-racist math might look like emerged, like so much else, in the summer of 2020. During those months, several math people in the teaching profession attempted to deconstruct one of the foundations of mathematics, indeed of logic itself, namely the fact that 2 plus 2 equals 4. According to these educators, the statement is not true. While 2 plus 2 can equal 4, it can also allegedly add up to other numbers, including 5. For some reason, perhaps to do with absolutely everything being caught up in a culture war, a crowd of people swiftly latched on to the claim. Others claimed that it was obvious that 2 plus 2 cannot equal 4 and gave a variety of reasons. These included, but were not limited to, claims that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is part of a hegemonic narrative, that the people who make such narratives should not get to decide what is true, that 2 plus 2 should equal whatever people want it to equal, and that making such a definitive statement excludes other ways of knowing. As the movement gathered force, one PhD candidate took to social media to declare that the idea of 2 plus 2 equaling 4 is cultural, and because of Western imperialism / colonization, we think of it as the only way of knowing. An ethnic studies math teacher at Washington State University called on people to attack the haters by proving that there are ways to make 2 plus 2 equal 5. Soon, a biostatistics PhD at Harvard was trying to help out by saying that numbers are quantitative measures and abstractions of real underlying things in the universe, and it's important to keep track of this when we use numbers to model the real world. Which cleared things up. Scores of other people, notably math teachers, took to social media to try to help out. Some people described the idea of 2 plus 2 equaling 4 as a simplification of reality. But the main aim of the activist teachers was clear: to sock it to the white supremacists by proving that 2 plus 2 does not equal 4. It is possible that none of these activists had read George Orwell's most famous book. Or it is possible that they had read it years before, forgotten it, dismissed it as a work of another dead white male, or, likeliest of all, assumed that its contents did not apply to them. But the whole 2 plus 2 equals 4 debate was especially instructive because in 1984 there is a resonant passage where Orwell writes that in the end the party would announce that 2 and 2 made 5, and you would have to believe it. It was inevitable that they should make that claim sooner or later. The logic of their position demanded it, not merely the validity of experience, but the very existence of external reality was tacitly denied by their philosophy. Too late, the bioethics PhD at Harvard, who had leapt into the 2 plus 2 equal 5 case, came to recognize the link to Orwell. When he was informed of it, he ended up describing it as unfortunate. It is possible to dismiss all of this as simply a set of culture warriors battling each other in the public square without much in the way of real-world repercussions. But such an interpretation would be utterly wrong. The drive to make math, when done correctly, into a symbol of white supremacy means that standards in the subject, as in any and all other subjects, will be lowered or expunged altogether. What other possibilities are there when everything that is provable is doubted and everything that can be tested is turned into part of the problem? The consequences of this are now spilling out at schools across America and the rest of the West. Across America, there are now precisely such attempts to alter or eliminate the admissions system, ridding the system of selective admissions and moving to a system of lottery-based admissions. This is based on the belief that selection favors specific racial groups and that in order to achieve equity, the system must be disrupted. One of those pushing for this in her district is San Francisco Public School Commissioner Allison Collins, who argued in 2020 that when we talk about merit, meritocracy, and especially meritocracy based on standardized testing, I'm just going to say it. In this day and age, we cannot mince words. Those are racist systems. If you're going to say that merit is, like, fair, it's the antithesis of fair, and it's the antithesis of just. Ibram X. Kendi is also against standardized testing in schools. People may be unsurprised to learn what accusation Kendi levels against standardized testing. In 2019, he said, "I'll say it again and again. Standardized tests have become the most effective racist weapon ever devised to objectively degrade black minds and legally exclude their bodies." This is not a fringe idea. Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, has said, "Standardized testing doesn't help kids learn, and it doesn't help teachers teach. We need to measure what matters." And what exactly is it that matters? We are never told. Of course, the consequences of the war on standardized testing can be easily foreseen. Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Alexandria, Virginia, is not only struggling with its problematic name, it has also been struggling in recent years to change its admissions policy in order to be less selective. As it happens, the school had already undergone a significant shift in its makeup. 20 years ago, 70% of the school's students were white. By 2020, 79% were minority ethnic, mostly from families of immigrant Asian origin. White students accounted for only 19% of the students that year. The failure to create any significant shift in the black admissions during this period was inevitably put down to systemic racism. And so, in the wake of the George Floyd murder, there was a move to introduce a lottery admissions policy, which was objected to by a large proportion of the school's parents. Those in favour of the policy said that they sought to have a school population that more closely mirrored the national population. But even if the policy was followed through, it would only have marginally altered the share of black and Hispanic students at the school. What it would have done is a number of other things. It would have meant a forced increase in the number of white students at the school, by roughly an extra 25%, and a forced decrease in the number of Asian students, by roughly an extra 20%. As other schools and colleges across the country struggle with the same problem, from New York to California, they continue to find themselves facing the same conundrum. If the problem in everything is racism, and the answer to everything is to disrupt the racist system, it appears to produce only two verifiable outcomes: a lowering of standards in the name of anti-racism, and a rise in the need for racist policies in order to deal with a problem that is always said to be racism. The war against standardized testing, like the war against religion, philosophy, and everything else in the West, does not erase racial differences. It foghorns them. Interlude. Gratitude. Toward the end of The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky writes a chapter of pure terror. Earlier in the novel, one of the brothers, Ivan, has laid out his own deeply conflicted views on the nature of mankind, God, and the devil. As the novel develops, Ivan's mental state deteriorates. Those around him seem to believe that he is slipping into delirium tremens, usually associated with alcohol withdrawal. But the cause of Ivan's fear is left unclear and unexplained. His younger brother, Alyosha, only realizes how bad things are when he meets his brother one evening by a lamppost and says something that causes Ivan to grip him and begin to tremble. "You have been in my room," Ivan accuses his brother. "You have been in my room at night when he came." Alyosha misunderstands who he is talking about. Ivan howls at him. "Do you know about his visits to me? How did you find out?" Later, when questioning the man who he thinks has killed his father, Ivan becomes seized with fear that this unnamed person is once again present in the room. He begins hastily looking in the corners for him. Eventually, the reader is allowed to be there when Ivan is visited by the devil, who is sitting in his rooms, dressed like a Russian gentleman, using French phrases and clearly from the class of former lily-fingered landowners who flourished in the days of serfdom. Apparently, the two have conversed before. But whether the devil is part of Ivan's consciousness or is actually before him is left unclear. The devil says that he wishes to be agreeable, but that he is misunderstood, a slandered man. He philosophizes, but complains that people do not want to hear from him. And then Dostoevsky gives his devil a passing observation that only such a genius as he could throw in so casually. The devil explains, "My best emotions, such as gratitude, for example, are formally forbidden me solely on account of my social position." Why should gratitude be an emotion that is denied to the devil? Dostoevsky leaves this unanswered, but it is worth reflecting on. For acts of deconstruction and destruction can be performed with extraordinary ease. Such ease that they might as well be the habits of the devil. A great building, such as a church or a cathedral, can take decades, even centuries, to build. But it can be burned to the ground or otherwise brought down in an afternoon. Similarly, the most delicate canvas or work of art can be the product of years of craft and labor, and it can be destroyed in a moment. The human body is the same. I once read a particular detail of the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. A gang of Hutus had been at their work, and among the people they macheted that day was a Tutsi doctor. As his brain spilled out onto the roadside, one of his killers mocked the idea that these were meant to be the brains of a doctor. How did his learning look now? All the years of education and learning, all the knowledge and experience in that head, was destroyed in a moment by people who had achieved none of those things. It is one of the saddest realizations we have as a species. Not just that everything is transitory, but that everything, particularly everything we love, and into which love has been poured, is fragile, and that just as the line between civilization and barbarism is paper thin, so it is a miracle that anything at all survives, given the fragility of all things, plus the evil and carelessness of which men are capable. What is it that drives that evil? Many things, without doubt. But one of them, identified by several of the great philosophers, is resentment, or ressentiment. That sentiment is one of the greatest drivers for people who want to destroy, blaming someone else for having something you believe you deserved more. Among those who have been interested in the question of ressentiment was Friedrich Nietzsche. It is alarming how specifically he diagnoses the type. At one point, he writes that any psychologist who wishes to study the subject must recognize that this plant thrives best among anarchists and anti-Semites today, so it flowers like it always has done, in secret, like a violet, but with a different scent. And just as like always gives rise to like, it will come as no surprise to find attempts coming once more from these circles, as so often before, to sanctify revenge with the term justice, as though justice were fundamentally simply a further development of the feeling of having been wronged, and, belatedly, to legitimize with revenge emotional reactions in general, one and all. For Nietzsche, one of the dangers of the men of ressentiment is that they will achieve their ultimate form of revenge, which is to turn happy people into unhappy people like themselves, to shove their misery into the faces of the happy, so that in due course the happy start to be ashamed of their happiness, and perhaps say to one another, "It's a disgrace to be happy. There is too much misery." This is something that must be averted, for the sick, says Nietzsche, must not make the healthy sick too, or make the healthy confuse themselves with the sick. He returns to the subject again and again, as though circling to get exactly to the root of the thing he is attempting to diagnose. Eventually, he makes the central insight, which is that ressentiment is at its heart a yearning for revenge, motivated by a desire to anesthetize pain through emotion. One needs the wildest possible emotion, he says, in order to arouse oneself to the crucial claim of the resentful person. Someone or other must be to blame that I feel ill. What answer is there to this devastating situation? Only one that Nietzsche can see. The men of ressentiment rip at wounds that have been closed, and open scars, and make themselves bleed to death from scars long since healed. Such people may drag down their friends, family, children, and everyone else around them, says Nietzsche. And the only answer is that someone must stand over the person, an ascetic priest in Nietzsche's telling, and say the most difficult thing, which is that they are quite right. It is true. Somebody must be to blame. But you yourself are this somebody. You yourself alone are to blame for yourself. Nietzsche recognizes that this is difficult. But if this was to be said, then if nothing else, one thing at least might be accomplished, which is that the direction of ressentiment could be changed. Others responded to Nietzsche's insights, notably Max Scheler and Helmut Schurk. They added to it by noting that resentment relies always on playing A off against B, in particular where A is praised solely and wholly in order to denigrate and devalue B. In all matters, whether to do with money, sex, or anything else, no man feels that the scales are weighted in his favour. And so, just as the men of resentment talk about justice while meaning revenge, so it is that something is disguised within their talk of equality. For anyone who talks of equality will find an inbuilt problem. Only a person who fears he will lose will demand equality as a universal principle. It is a speculation, says Schurk, on a falling market. For it is a law according to which people can only be equal in respect of those characteristics having the least value. Equality, as a purely rational idea, can never stimulate desire, will, or emotion. But resentment, in whose eyes the higher values never find favour, conceals its nature in the demand for equality. In reality, it wants nothing less than the destruction of all those who embody those higher values which arouse its anger. This is another deeply pertinent insight. For all talk of equality, like the talk of justice, presents itself in one light, not least a disinterested light, as though its proponents only want an abstract thing and hardly notice whether or not this thing will ever benefit themselves. But very often, it is no such thing. A set of far more fundamental issues are working themselves out. In other words, it may be worth recognizing what we are up against when we hear the critics of the West today. For just as we are not up against justice, but rather up against vengeance, so we are not truly up only against proponents of equality, but also against those who hold a pathological desire for destruction. An only vaguely milder version of this has existed in plain sight for decades. That is the obsession that started in the academy and then spread elsewhere that is given over to the veneration of deconstruction. This is the process by which everything from the past can be picked over, picked apart, and eventually destroyed. It can find no way of building. It can only find a way of endlessly pulling apart. So, a novel by Jane Austen is taken apart until a delicate work of fiction is turned instead into nothing more than another piece of guilty residue from a discredited civilization. What has been achieved in this? Nothing but a process of destruction. Those who have made a career out of this find a number of things in their favour. One is the fact that their task is potentially endless, as the possible subjects appear limitless. It is a career for life for the deconstructionists, but still nothing is created or even produced at the end of this process. The only possible demand at the end point of deconstruction is to deconstruct some more, and it seems possible to pull apart and find cause for resentment endlessly. Certainly, that is the hope of the deconstructionists, who now scour the world of art and look for symbols of rape, male dominance, privilege, racism, and much more. And of course they find things to occupy their time. For you might easily look at a painting and ask what errant thoughts might have been behind it. You might also ask what labour went into it, and whether any forced or unpaid labour was involved in it. You might look at the paint colours and question the origins of the pigments, whether they were legitimately or sustainably acquired. You might ask what pay the apprentices in the artist's studio received, and whether everyone had been adequately compensated by their superior to produce this work for a man of even greater power. You might pull its subjects apart and interrogate its meanings in the light of things that have come after it. You might see all manner of things. You might lament the lack of representation of any kind. Or you might step back and see the Madonna of the Rocks by Leonardo da Vinci, the Annunciation by Sandro Botticelli, or any number of other works of art stretching back across centuries of creation by the masters. It is the same with buildings. You might look at the great cathedrals and other monuments of Europe and ask who carried all these stones or winched them up, whether they were appropriately paid for their labour, and whether the conditions at the time were consistent with modern standards of worker safety. You might ask why people of only one skin colour appear to be represented in the monuments, or why people only of European background appear to be mentioned on them. You may even ask whether the act of building a structure to a particular god in the name of a particular religion or denomination is not in some way exclusive, even exclusionary. You might ask where the money for these great structures came from, whether that money was honestly acquired, or whether some portion of the money was taken illegitimately from the poor, the needy, or even from other countries and peoples who had no say in where these finances went. You could do all these things and more. Or you could stand back and admire the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris, the Cappella San Severo in Naples, the Duomo in Florence, or tens of thousands of cathedrals, churches, chapels, and other monuments. Why should we not simply stand back and credit our good fortune to have inherited these things, and enjoy the great good fortune of being able to live among them? These are a gift from humans to all humankind. The reason is that what we have seen in recent decades in the West has been a grand project of deconstruction and destruction, fueled by resentment and revenge. In this process, the West has been settled on as the evil one in the global search for blame. Obviously, many people inside the West have found it comforting to settle into this mindset as well. The men of resentment have had an easy time pointing to things that the West has done, pointing to bills unpaid and outrages forgotten or insufficiently atoned for. Such people have enjoyed reopening ancient sores and claiming to feel hurt for wounds and wrongs done long before they themselves were ever alive. They have felt contentment through opening up these old wounds and demanding that people pity them afresh as though they themselves were the victims, because to do so is to place themselves at the centre of all things, to expect recompense forever, and never to have to look to themselves to address anything, even if it is something they could only address themselves. Such people have nothing to say about themselves or about anyone outside of the West, because to do so might lead them to change the direction in which their resentment is funneled. It might, in fact, cause them to finally turn their gaze on themselves. If the West is not responsible for all ills in the world, in its past and in the past and present of others, then other actors must be held responsible. And some people would have to look to themselves to explain their lack of outcomes achievements, and more. They would have to look into the causes of their discontents and see that at least one of them is themselves. How much easier it is to keep claiming that another party, and a vast historic party at that, is responsible for all the ills of the world and of their own lives. In recent decades, the sick have indeed infected the healthy and dragged them down into a demented discourse of their own invention. They have pulled almost everyone around them into the zero-sum discussion that insists that the history of the West is a history of patriarchal oppression, sexism, racism, transphobia, homophobia, larceny, and much more. These people take an interest in other societies solely in order to play them off against the West. They are interested in native tribes solely in order to try to demonstrate how bankrupt the West is. And they are interested in every other civilization in no serious sense. They do not learn the languages of other civilizations or study their cultures in any depth, certainly to nothing like the extent that the much derided Orientalists and others from the Western past did. But they praise any culture, so long as it is not Western, solely and simply in order to denigrate and devalue the West. As a result, they reach their final end argument, which is to demand why anyone should admire or wish to continue a civilization that has done so much wrong and had such bigotry and hatred built in throughout its history. Of course, there are many responses that can be made to this. And there are also some answers. For if someone offered me this litany of wrongs of the West, I could reply most easily in a few words. Paris. That is one that I would select early. Venice, I might say next. Rome is not nothing. Nor is Florence a dump. In fact, just to stay with cities, surely Vienna, Prague, Madrid, Lisbon, and Budapest count for something. What about New York or Chicago? The list could go on endlessly. You might linger on any one country for hours, but this points to a fact that is missing. For if you are to weigh a thing up, then you must not simply pile things up on one side of the scale. You must put something on the other side too. If you put the fact that the West has had racism in its history and leave the scale weighted only on that side, then of course you will come out with unbalanced judgments. And that is what has been allowed to happen. But must the good things not count for something? What about the great cathedral and university towns of the West? Oxford and Cambridge, Heidelberg and Regensburg, Ely and Salisbury, Bologna and Valencia. Why is it possible to discuss the whole history and guilt of the West and not linger on these jewels even for a moment? It is because the people of resentment are intent on forbidding the best emotions. What are those emotions? The most important, without doubt, is gratitude. The reason Dostoevsky's devil cannot feel gratitude is that only a person intent on great evil would be denied or deny themselves this crucial human attribute. Without an ability to feel gratitude, all of human life and human experience is a marketplace of blame, where people tear up the landscape of the past and present, hoping to find other people to blame and upon whom they can transfer their frustrations. Without gratitude, the prevailing attitudes of life are blame and resentment. Because if you do not feel any gratitude for anything that has been passed on to you, then all you can feel is bitterness over what you have not got. Bitterness that everything did not turn out better or more exactly to your liking, whatever that liking might be. Without some sense of gratitude, it is impossible to get anything into any proper order. For, of course, it is possible to lament what did not come to you or did not happen for you. That process could be endless, and everybody on earth could play it. The more important task of life is to recognize what you do not have, while being grateful for what you do. You might regard it as a terrible thing that not everybody in the Western past always held views wholly in accordance with the social and moral values that we happen to adhere to in the 2020s. You might deride that fact or otherwise pick over it. But it makes no sense to do so unless you also recognize, for instance, that to live in the West in this time is to enjoy a piece of historical good fortune, unlike almost any good fortune in history. You might feel some regret that things happened in the 18th century that people are not proud of today, but you might balance that out by feeling some gratitude to be part of a civilization in which all human life came to be regarded as sacred, in which people are regarded as being endowed with innate dignity, in which peace is the normal state of affairs, and where wrongs done in the current day can be remedied through the application of the law. I have been to many parts of the world where some or all of these things are missing, where life is able to be ended with exceptional brutality, and with no recourse to any courts or other system of justice. I have visited many countries where peace is the exception, not the norm, and where young people who want to make a difference in their society have absolutely no chance of ever doing so. The world is full of countries outside the West where the things that people in the West take for granted are ideas that seem centuries in the future, if they are conceivable at all. Places that, unlike the West, are not interested in openness to the world, and are not remotely concerned with self-criticism, progress, or any other form of betterment. People who have the good fortune to live in the West are not just the inheritors of comparatively good economic fortune. They have inherited a form of government, justice, and law for which they ought to feel profound gratitude. It may not always be perfect, but it is better by far than any of the alternatives on offer. And when it comes to what we in the West have inherited all around us, this must count as one of the greatest gifts, if not the greatest gift, that any civilization has left for those who came after. A gift not just in liberal order and beautiful cities and landscapes, but in artistic achievement, cultural inheritance, and a wealth of examples of how to live. Examples never exceeded anywhere on earth. And we do not defend these things because they are created by white people, any more than we would wish to defend Thomas Jefferson or David Hume simply because they were white males. Such people, ideas, buildings, and cities of the West are worthy of respect not because they are the product of white people, but because they are the inheritance of all mankind. It is possible today to fixate on the identity of these people and to demand that we tear this all down, or, more moderately, that we tear some of it down. But a saner, more reasonable approach would be to look at what we have inherited that is good and try to build on top of it. In the last year of his life, the English philosopher Roger Scruton underwent a set of trials and misfortunes inflicted upon him by others. Perhaps distracted by these trials, he discovered too late that a cancer had grown inside him and would end his life in not much more than 6 months. The last thing he wrote was a reflection on that year of life, what he had been through, and all the terrible things that had happened to him. But, he said, and they were the last words he published before his death, "Coming close to death, you begin to know what life means. And what it means is gratitude." There are many attitudes that we all take in our lives, some of which dominate at one point in our lives and recede in another. But a life lived without gratitude is not a life properly lived. It is a life that is lived off kilter, one in which, incapable of realizing what you have to be thankful for, you are left with nothing but your resentments, and can be contented by nothing but revenge. Chapter 4. Culture. In the freezing January of 1928, a young British artist could be found in the basement of London's Tate Gallery, repainting his first major commission. Rex Whistler was just 21 when he was chosen to design and paint a mural that would cover all four walls of the long refreshment room of the gallery. The result was titled In Pursuit of Rare Meats, a fantasy portrayal of the Duke of Epicurania and his court heading out to find morsels across an imaginary land. At the mural's unveiling in December 1927, George Bernard Shaw gave one of the speeches. The socialist playwright managed to upset the artist's mother first by mentioning Whistler's more famous American namesake, no relation, and second, by implying that Rex, who was not from a wealthy family, was not a gentleman. That aside, the launch was a triumph. The fantastical, idyllic, occasionally macabre scenes with which Whistler had covered the walls were packed with what would become his signature touches. Great trompe-l'oeil columns around the doorways and the windows, great lakes and seas with mermaids, and a landscape scattered with deserted Arcadian temples in an expanse of rolling countryside. Throughout this land, strange figures feasted, chased, preened, hobbled, and charged. At one end was a portion of an idyllic city, at another a unicorn escaping the notice of a party of strange characters in a wood. The work took Whistler and his assistant, Nan West, a grueling 18 months, and Whistler was paid £5 a week. He turned down invitations and postponed visits to his closest friends to get the vast work finished. That was the origin of Shaw's joke, that Whistler had been paid by the week and therefore was like a plumber who came in with his bag of tools. Still, the Times and other newspapers praised the work from the moment of its unveiling. "The most amusing room in Europe," was one of the titles given to it by the press. There was a heavy snowfall that winter, followed by a sudden thaw, and in January the River Thames burst its banks. On the night of January the 6th, the filthy water of the river poured through into the lower ground floor of the Tate and all through the just unveiled room. When the waters receded, the artist went in, accompanied by a friend, to inspect the damage. The river had left a line of scum 8 feet above the floor. "The whole room is completely wrecked," Whistler wrote in a letter. "The canvas had peeled off in places. The floors and furnishings were ruined." "Well," the artist said, as he stood in the ruins of his work, "at least the mermaids came into their own." The room was closed to the public again, and Whistler immediately set about the desultory work of redoing his first major work. I have always found there to be something deeply touching about the character as well as the work of Rex Whistler. He was astoundingly talented, had more technical ability than almost anyone of his generation, and possessed an invention and ease that made everything he painted instantly recognizable. He was also loved by everyone who knew him, or even just met him, men and women alike. He worked exceptionally hard at his vocation, had a number of unreciprocated passions for women from a different social class than his own, and was just beginning to master the art of oil painting when World War II broke out. Whistler volunteered to join up straight away, and while he could have got a comparatively cushy job as a war artist, he seemed to feel that wouldn't be right, and instead joined up with the Welsh Guards, eventually training to become a tank commander. Throughout his years of training, he continued to paint, amusing his regiment with specially painted murals and cartoons, and continuing to design stage sets and book designs, among other work, all through those terrible years. For Christmas 1941, he designed the cover of the Listener magazine. The image is of St. George defeating the dragon, atop a pile of skulls, surrounded by a motif of bayonets, books, musical instruments, and the theatrical masks of comedy and tragedy. In the winter of 1943-44, while doing final training with his tank battalion in the south of England, he designed the stage sets for Le Spectre de la Rose, starring Margot Fonteyn in London. The war-exhausted audiences reportedly sighed with delight when the curtain first went up. A few months later, the artist was on his way to Normandy, France. Whistler's tank crew engaged the Nazi enemy in what was then the largest solely British tank battle of the war. As Whistler attempted to dash from one of his tanks to another, he was killed by enemy fire. It was his first day of action. He was just 39. Almost 80 years later, in December 2020, it was announced that the Tate was expected to permanently close the Whistler restaurant. The decision followed a set of complaints 2 years earlier about the mural. A member of the board, who was also chair of the gallery's ethics committee, one Moya Green, looked into the complaints and, after leading a thorough investigation into what was on the walls of the gallery, she reported back to her fellow trustees. The committee members were, she said, unequivocal in their view that the imagery of the work is offensive. Worse, she reported, the offence is compounded by the use of the room as a restaurant. By the time the committee reported, the restaurant had already been closed because of COVID, but even when the galleries reopened, the condemned restaurant did not. The problem the ethics committee had found was that Whistler's mural, unveiled a century earlier, had depictions of non-Europeans. The depiction of Chinese people in one tiny corner of the mural was deemed to portray the Chinese in a stereotypical way. Worse was that in one of the strange hunting parties, a woman in a frilly frock appears to be dragging a black child, who must be a slave, and hauling him off against his will. It is one of several disturbing scenes in the mural. What, if anything, was Whistler trying to say through such tiny details? None of the guilty characters in question is more than a couple of inches high. A reasonable interpretation is that even in Arcadia, there is cruelty and suffering, as well as Epicureanism and delight. It is a typical touch. There was always a worm in Whistler's Arcadias. In a later mural, he painted himself into a corner of the room, dressed as a street sweep. In the Tate mural, there is a tiny white boy drowning in one corner, while at the highest point of a cliff, Whistler places an urn with the initials D.A.W., a reference to his older brother, Denny, who had died in childhood. For decades, all of this was accepted as part of the work. As late as the early 2010s, when the Tate carried out a much-needed cleaning of the mural, no concerns were raised about it. Indeed, the complex restoration project was reported on by the BBC and others with no hint of any problem. Only a decade ago, the room still delighted and amused. When the restaurant reopened in 2013, those who praised it included The Guardian's restaurant critic, who noted the immersive fairground ride and sylvan beauty of Whistler's fantasy, while also praising the excellence of the restaurant's wine list. It was just 5 years later that the Tate first received complaints about the Whistler mural. These seem all to have come from an Instagram account called The White Pube. When this account first noticed the Whistler mural, it also noted that the restaurant website quoted The Guardian's reviewer's praise of the wine list. The White Pube put these two together, fulminating, "How do these rich white people still choose to go there to drink from the capital's finest wine cellars with some choice slavery in the background? Tate, you are all deranged." The authors of that post were one Gabrielle de la Puente and Zarina Mohammed. Back then, the museum had responded to this intolerable pressure from one Instagram account by trying to contextualize the minor figures in the mural. The text that Tate came up with to post online and display by the mural noted that the painting was one of Whistler's most important works, but declared that it did indeed contain a number of scenes that were unacceptable. It described the scenes as imperialist, as though a Duke of Epicurania ever had ridden across the land, and continued, "These depictions demonstrate attitudes to racial identity prevalent in Britain in the 1920s. The weakening of the British Empire around this time paradoxically prompted cultural expressions of the superiority of the British race." In time, the specialist and national media were all onto it, with one site lamenting that for years tourists had been clinking china alongside a massive mural that depicts child slavery. Of course, if any tea drinkers were worried about that, then they'd just have to wait and see some of the themes that would confront them in the galleries above their heads. Soon, an online petition was got up. This carefully selected the two tiny images, blew them up to a fuller size, and put them on either side of a carefully selected photo of a group of white people of a certain age looking satisfied after finishing a meal in the restaurant. The petition was titled, "Remove the Racist and Harmful Pursuit of Rare Meats Mural at Tate Britain's Rex Whistler." It continued in similarly strident tones, "Tate Britain allowing this overtly racist painting to remain for diners' enjoyment is not acceptable. changes need to be made in either removing the painting from the restaurant or removing the restaurant from mural room itself. There simply should not be a dining experience open in this modern and multicultural Britain where all races are not respected. Incensed signatories claimed that so long as the Tate held on to this mural, the institution was showing that it was not committed to racial justice. As the petition began to get more and more signatures, the Tate seemed to think it was on the run. By the time that some hundreds of people had signed, a spokesperson for the gallery announced that Tate has been open and transparent about the deeply problematic racist imagery in the Rex Whistler mural, and the gallery insisted that the interpretation text now on the wall alongside the mural was part of the gallery's efforts to confront the racist and imperialist attitudes in the 1920s and today. A spokesperson for the Tate announced that their work in confronting such histories went hand in hand with championing a more inclusive story of British art and identity today. Nevertheless, when the Tate Ethics Committee reported back in 2020, they were dismissive of the gallery's initial efforts. They unequivocally condemned the mural, insisted that the gallery had not dealt with the situation adequately, and concluded that the only possible options were for the room to be closed or for the mural to be removed. At the time of writing, the Tate is preparing for an external consultation on the mural's fate. In the meantime, the room remains closed to the public. Of course, the more you look into the matter,